This is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctors Digest. It's great to get together with you again. I hope you've had a wonderful summer, lots of family time, and maybe some breaks from your busy work schedule. And now we're getting ready to head into the fall, and a lot of issues we're hearing in the news every day, what's going on in our country, some of them very shocking things we never imagined we would be facing or our children would be facing. That's why this issue of Christian Doctors Digest, we're going to be equipping you to deal with these issues, and we've got a wonderful lineup. Jim Garlow, who is the senior pastor at Skyline Church in San Diego and a New York Times bestselling author, he's going to talk to us about his newest resource, Well-Versed, Biblical Answers to Today's Tough Questions. And we're going to have a great conversation. And then we're going to get together with Jeff Keenan and kind of give you an update. Jeff's been a longtime friend, helped me start the National Embryo Donation Center, which he runs, and talk about embryo adoption and some of the things that are happening in the technology surrounding reproduction that you should be aware of. And next, we're going to get together with Casey Maddox from the Alliance Defending Freedom. We work with them frequently on public policy issues. We're going to talk about academic freedom, healthcare right of conscience, and other issues to equip you in that arena as well. So we got a lot lined up. You're going to get a lot smarter when this is over. At least I hope so. Let's get to our first guest. I want to introduce you to a good friend, Dr. Jim Garlow. Jim spoke at our national conference in California a few years ago. He's an author, a communicator, a commentator, historian, cultural observer, and senior pastor at Skyline Wesleyan Church in San Diego. He has a PhD from Drew, 3 master's degrees, and has received leadership and courage awards from lots of organizations, you know, the Pacific Justice Institute, the Family Research Council, the Western Center for Law and Policy, the California Eagle Forum. He's heard daily on 830 radio stations on the Garlow Perspective, a one-minute commentary, does a 30-minute broadcast as well. He's been over 1,000 stations, TV, radio, and print, and interviews. Very knowledgeable, been on Dr. Phil, Larry King Live, Glenn Beck, Fox and Friends, NBC, CNN, Fox, and all the litany of other stations. And we're going to have a discussion about his new book, Well-Versed, Biblical Answers for Today's Tough Questions, something that I think should be in your library and probably on your bedside table to teach you how to approach these tough questions from a biblical perspective. Let's get to Jim. Jim, you have written a great book, which I want to recommend to our members, called Well-Versed, Biblical Answers to Today's Tough Questions. I know you've been active in these issues going on in our culture for many years. That's pretty unusual for a pastor, and maybe that's where we should start. The church has often been very silent on these large social issues and moral issues in our culture that are coming down.
Well, I like to think of them not just merely cultural issues or social issues. They're biblical issues, and that's why the church should not be silent. We should be as verbal as the Scripture is and speak to the same issues that the Bible speaks to. There's been some intriguing research that comes from 2013, 2014, and 2015. And in 2013, George Barna, a well-known American pollster, discovered in his research that 90% of pastors agreed that the Bible speaks to the political and social issues of our day. But later on in the survey, when they were asked, 90% of those same pastors said they would not speak out on what the Bible does speak out on, which is a pretty jolting bit of information. The following year, in 2014, the Pew Research poll showed an immediate change in American thinking. 2 lines suddenly crossed. The lines across were, it had been higher line on the graph saying people don't want their churches to speak out on political and social topics. But all of a sudden, that line plummeted down, and a line started plummeting, I mean, shooting up, saying we want our pastors, our churches to speak out on social political issues. It actually crossed. 49% wanted them to speak out, 48% saying they did not. Now, it was such a change, I actually thought it was an aberration in their polling initially. Then in 2015, in August, George Barna again released an incredible research project in which he discovered that people in the Pew identified 22 different political topics that they wanted their pastor to teach them on. And at the conclusion of that research project, it was revealed in their responses. Now, these are parishioners, not pastors responding. They said, we're quiet on the issues. We don't speak out. But we're not quiet because we're afraid. We're quiet because we don't know what to say. And as a result of that, I wrote the book Well-Versed, Biblical Answers to Today's Tough Issues, which literally lays out the biblical underpinnings of about 30 different political topics.
Well, and you've did a very comprehensive job, and it's well documented as well. What you're saying about parishioners, I think, is true for anybody that's concerned about these issues, including our membership. You know, you see these things happening, but sometimes it's out of fear because of the attacks that take place. And secondly, you just don't feel qualified to speak out. So that's why I think the tool you've put together is so important. Let's talk about religion in the public square, which you get into in part two of the book. And there's a big shift going on. I mean, freedom of religion doesn't mean that anymore to a lot of people. It's freedom of worship, and even that's being attacked.
Yeah, and there's quite a difference between that. Now, just so that our listeners understand fully, freedom of religion is what's called for in the First Amendment. But freedom of worship, which is a phrase that's been used by both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in public venues, actually means you can do what you want in the four walls of your church, at least for now, but you had better not take it outside of that. You better not go into the public square. You better not carry your Christian values into the workplace, into school, into the university, anywhere outside your church. In fact, questionable whether you can even carry it into your own home. And so that has been a radical change. Christians need to understand, one senator, Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, took on one entire department of the government when they listed the freedom of worship. And he took them on quite an expose, pressed them for months, and they finally were willing eventually under his pressure to yield and put their phrasing back to freedom of religion, which is considerably different than just freedom of worship, which limits you what you do in your church building.
Well, and that's happened over a good number of years, just the privatization of religion. I mean, it's your private beliefs, and that's fine. Just don't let it affect anything else. We're seeing that in the schools. We're seeing it everywhere else.
It actually was fine, but now it's moved from the marginalization, which in the privatization you used, and now it's full-bore criminalization of Christianity. So we've seen it step up quite a notch in the last couple of years, and the Obergefell, June the 26th of 2015 case from the Supreme Court on sodomite marriage or homosexual marriage, so-called marriage, that one has caused it to go considerably higher. And now, of course, the transsexual laws and gender identity laws, they pressed it to a whole new limit, with some fines going as high as $125,000 or $250,000 in New York, or even Princeton University. You don't say his and her anymore. You have to use other he and she. You can't use that. And in some places in California, they're trying to rule out in the school districts no longer using the term boy and girl. That's how severe this has gotten.
How do you approach this biblically? I mean, there's things that are very explicit in the Bible on some of these issues we've talked about. But then how do you go beyond that? I liked what you did in the book talking about, you know, the things that are very clear. There's the principles then you apply, and then there's the inferences you imply. Explain that to us.
Yeah, the scripture is crystal clear on many of these topics that we speak about. Marriage would be a clear example. Even abortion, though the word abortion is never used in scripture. but it's really quite self-explanatory on that issue. There isn't wiggle room. The next one we look at is just overarching principles. What are the principles that might apply to this? Well, the Supreme Court, for example, is not mentioned in the Bible, and yet the element of judges and integrity and justice. And so there's the principles you would draw on. Then there's the what inferences. On that one, for example, my chapter on taxation, we acknowledge that the Bible is not clear in terms of a maximum taxation or an actual taxation schedule. But in that one, I present the idea that it's quite possible that though there's a vast difference between the theocracy of ancient Israel and the constitutional republic based on democratic principles that we enjoy in the United States, there still could be some things we borrow from one across the millennia to the present. And what would happen if we do that? So those are more the inferences. And the fourth category, those things where it doesn't have any clear scriptural admonition one way or another, and so we simply choose not to cover those.
I think that's extremely helpful to people, too, and you point out very clearly that that's how you approach it in the book. Let's deal with a couple of these current issues that are really hot right now, because we could talk about a lot of things, but let's talk about same-sex marriage and what the Bible has to say about that and the impact that you are concerned about on our culture and on our families and everyone else.
It's important to know the American people have been really quite rock solid in the sense that 31 states have voted to affirm traditional, historic, natural, as opposed to unnatural, marriage. Only three states, and in those states, the cause for righteousness was outspent 4-1, in one case 10-1, had ever voted for a so-called homosexual marriage. So if we go back to the scripture, I'll try not to take us into the weeds too deeply, but this is part of the richness of the text that every pastor, every Christian leader, every person should understand. That is, in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, when it lays out the biblical underpinnings of the nature of marriage, we got to start with this notion that God is neither male nor female. Because when we say we're made in the image of God, the fact is no male by himself is a full expression of the full spectrum of who God is. No female by herself is. The reason I say that is because the writers in the Old Testament, they'll use many words we historically associate with masculinity, strength and such, but they'll turn right around and use numbers of descriptors of God that we historically associate with femininity. God's depicted as one who's holding a newborn babe close to the breast, or a womb that's now birthing one. So there's language in Deuteronomy and Isaiah and Psalms, other books, where God is depicted not just with the masculinity terms, but with femininity terms. So what does this mean? It means God is more. He's not male or female. We understand that. So when we're made in the full image of God, if we unpack the Hebrew meaning, the Hebrew text, let's go beyond the English, let's go into Hebrew, and here we go. When it says that God created Adam, we tend to think God created a man, then a rib was taken, and created Eve. If we're looking even in like an NIV Bible, you'll see footnotes. If you look at those footnotes, they're very important. The Hebrew text reads, I think, as the follows. God created, as that is not capital A, Adam, a male, a name. It's Adam. God created Adam. Adam, small a. Small a means humanity. God created humanity. He looked at what he had created. This was humanity. Don't think of a male or Adam yet. Think of Adam, humanity. He created humanity. He looked at that and said, it's not good to be alone, and the translation can be in the Hebrew. It's not good as one. In other words, no relational capability. There's one unit. It's at that point we have what's called the splitting of the atom. In other words, he removes the femininity, and what we have left is masculinity. And so we have the two complementary halves of humanity now. One might say, wait a minute, what about the rib and turning Eve? Well, the word there is sela, T-S-E-L-A, the Hebrew word, and it actually has the meaning of side or half. So God removed the half, or he removed the side. It's when those two come back together, male and female, in the covenantal components of marriage, and that's one of the strong reasons for sexual attraction is the hunger and desire for the two halves of humanity to be united, to be a full expression of God. Hmm. One of the names for God, for example, in Genesis 17 is El Shaddai. El, the mighty one, Shaddai, coming from the word breast, nourishing a newborn baby. And so what we have is God created Adam, humankind. He split Adam, and now we have male and female. If we take it a step further, the Hebrew word for man is ish, I-S-H. The Hebrew word for woman is isha, I-S-H-A-H. Now, there's something intriguing about those two words when you look at it in the Hebrew, not in the English, but in the Hebrew. There's one letter in ish that is not in isha. That's the letter yod. We think of Y for our purposes in English. There's one letter in isha that is not in ish. That's the letter hey. We just kind of think of the H in English. So when we put those two together, when male and female come together, ish and isha come together, you have two unique letters to each word, and that's YH, which forms the foundation for Yahweh, the name of God, the name that's used 6,800 times in our Old Testament. And so we have the very name of God stamped on male and female coming together, the two complementary halves of humanity, and when they come together, they're the image of God. No male by himself, no female by herself. Expresses the full spectrum of the image of God. But as they come back together, how are they the image of God? Well, just one example would be God is creative. Well, the husband and wife, as they come together, they are procreative. They produce life. Nobody can explain how it is that a sperm and an egg come together and produce life. We know scientifically it happens, but nobody can explain how actually does that happen. A sperm and an egg creates a new person, a new life. That's part of the miraculous of being in the image of God, being a creator with him. If people understand that, they'll understand how reverential God views marriage. We won't park here on this next one long, but if we did a flyover from Genesis to Revelation, Genesis, of course, is the account of a marriage of a man and a woman. Revelation closes with the wedding of a bride and a groom. And in Revelation, we're going to see something very similar to why God cares about marriage. And that is that when Paul writes in Ephesians 5 about the nature of marriage, he's talking about the consummation of history when Christ and the church are married. And none of us can understand that. Paul says it's a mystery in Ephesians 5. It's a complete mystery. We can't grasp it. So Paul uses the example of marriage on earth to depict the ultimate marriage, which is in the closure of history. So none of us have seen yet a capital M marriage, a real marriage. We have seen an hors d'oeuvres of it, an appetizer course. We've seen small M marriage. And if we think of the best marriage we can think of on earth, and I hope it's each one, the person that's listening right now, it's their own marriage, that's only a small M. And that small M marriage on earth, God established for the purpose of giving us some kind of glimpse, some kind of understanding what real marriage, capital M marriage, is, the culmination of history, when Christ and the church as groom and bride come together as one. I can't comprehend that, but I can comprehend husband and wife coming together on this earth, so it gives me a clue. And we even use, when we describe the closure of history, we even use marital bed language sometimes, consummation of history, a climax of history. So the conclusion of all this is, if I were Satan, I would want to destroy the image of God in Genesis, male and female coming together. I would want to destroy the picture of the closure of history at Christ and the church. I'd want to destroy the earthly picture of that so that people would lose a glimpse of the image of God in Revelation and the closure of history in Revelation.
Wow. Good stuff, good stuff. And you kept us thinking as you went through it and gave us some very important stuff. Jim, you've addressed so many issues in here, from economics to law and society to foreign policy to political participation to religion in the public square. The book is just so rich with scripture and then just practical applications. And I want to I want to thank you for this work that you did and this tool that you put in our hands, not only to better educate ourselves on these issues so we can be salt and light, but also to educate others. And I would challenge our members to do that in their churches, in their communities, in their small group Bible studies or whatever. This would just make an excellent text to educate people, because if we've ever needed understanding and equipping on a topic in the public square, we need it now with what's going on in our country and the rapid changes we're seeing. I really appreciate what you've done.
Just some encouragement for them. When you reference Bible studies, we're just now launching a new website. It will be called, well, of course, the book is called Well-Versed, and the website is called wellversedbook.com. And on there, we have videos. I've done videos, video introductions and summaries for all 31 chapters, 31
Wonderful.
Different videos. And there are study questions to use in a small group. There are helps for the leader with answers for whoever leads the small group. There's information on getting the audio version. There's many scripture references in the book. If you don't have time to look them all up, then I have them all there in order, all completely typed out, all the scriptures. So if they go to wellversedbook.com, they'll find a resource to help them use it in small group discussions. And, of course, they can pick the book up at, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble is carrying it, their local bookstores as well.
Yeah. Jim, thank you for taking some time out of your busy schedule. I have such fond memories of your time with us at our national meeting a few years ago and the blessing that was to us. And you've blessed us again. Thanks for all you're doing for the kingdom.
My joy to be on with you, my friend. Thank you.
Not only is his book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, we have it here at CMDA, so you can give us a call at 888-230-2637. One of our life and health resource people will be happy to get it to you, or you can go on to the web at cmda.org and order it there. I encourage you not only to read the book, but be the innovator at your church to make this a small group curriculum. All the materials are there. And people really need to talk about these issues. They're talking about them everywhere else but in the church. And that's a tragedy. We need to know what the Bible says on these issues so we know how our responsibility is in addressing them. It's great to have Jeff Anderson back with us from our stewardship department. He's the director of planned giving to give us a tax-wise moment. And today, Jeff, we're going to talk about timely ways to use stock for stewardship. We've had a great run in the stock market over the last number of months.
We have, Dave. And with the Dow up over 9% in North America and the S&P 500 up over 10%, it sure seems like the time to look at our investment, our stock portfolios, to think, what ways may I be able to use some of those appreciated stocks in my stewardship?
You know, it's kind of foolish to go in and give cash when you can give stock and then you don't have to pay taxes on the capital gains or dividends.
That's right. That's right. When we examine our assets, Dave, usually we think of writing a check or, in effect, giving cash first for our stewardship goals. But the question we need to ask ourselves, is that always the best way to give for ministry from a tax perspective? If we give an appreciated stock, then that gift has two distinct tax-wise advantages. First, we receive an income tax deduction on our federal return for the fair market value of that stock gift. And number two, we can completely avoid capital gains taxation on the amount of the appreciation of the stock. So we could be avoiding what would otherwise be substantial capital gains, reducing the value of that gift.
I've done this myself, and one of the reasons I like it is I can give more, and that's exciting, that I can have a greater impact on a ministry. So how difficult is it for people? I mean, they're thinking about this, oh, man, I don't have time. I'm so busy. You know, how hard is this to do?
We know our members are incredibly busy medical professionals, Dave. But quite frankly, the process is easy. It's simple, particularly in this day and age through electronic transfer. The process essentially is you, if your broker holds a stock or your investment portfolio, you call up her or call up him and say, let's take a look at which stocks make the best opportunities to give for my church, for CMDA, for ministry. And then that broker will electronically transfer that stock to the ministry or church's stock account. I would stress, however, one very critical caveat, though, in the transfer process. Because of financial privacy laws in the United States, almost always when that stock is transferred and comes to a charitable organization, it does not come with the name or the names of the donors who transferred the stock. So that can complicate this process a bit, Dave. And as a best practice, we strongly recommend that our members or donors call us and let us know what stock, the name of the stock, how many shares they're transferring to CMDA. And if you'll call us or email us, we'll be glad to walk you through that process. It'd be our privilege to do so.
Yeah, that's important because you don't want this mystery stock. Now what do we do with it?
Exactly.
Who gave it? Don't know to say thank you to. So.
Exactly.
Give me a couple pointers, to help me know how to transfer this stock. Just some insights.
Sure, Dave. First of all, the appreciated stock must have been owned by the donor for at least one calendar year in order to take advantage of giving a stock and avoiding the capital gains exposure. And most of us that have been investors for decades know occasionally, we hope it's just occasionally, have a stock that doesn't go up in value, but it goes down.
That's
right. It depreciates in value. If you decide that you want to sell a stock that's depreciated in value, that's exactly the better thing and the better practice to do is to sell the depreciated stock, and then you may want to use the cash proceeds for ministry.
How are other ways to use stock for stewardship?
Dave, not only is there that time-tested and way that we just discussed that many of our members have familiarity with, and many of our members use every week to support our ministry, but there are other ways to use those stocks as well. First of all, you can fund a charitable gift annuity. A charitable gift annuity is a time-honored and tested way to generate a lifetime income. And also, you can create tax benefits in the form of a tax deduction when you fund the CGA with appreciated stock. Now, generally anywhere from 60 to 70% or more of those quarterly lifetime payments under the charitable gift annuity will be free from federal income tax during your life expectancy. And again, funding a charitable gift annuity with an appreciated stock can generate very favorable tax results with some capital gains avoidance. A CGA is a very simple agreement and a very simple way to generate a lifetime income and a new wrinkle to many of our members on a way to use an appreciated stock.
Yeah, I know a good number of members have do that, have done it for CMDA, their church, and other groups. What about charitable remainder trust? That would be something else people aren't familiar with.
Exactly. A charitable remainder trust is a trust arrangement under the Internal Revenue Code where you transfer property, such as an appreciated stock. It can be real property. It can be other types of property. But let's focus on an appreciated stock. You generate lifetime income by transferring that appreciated stock to a charitable remainder trust. And that lifetime income can be for yourself and for your spouse, usually. And then at the passing of the second spouse or income beneficiary, the remaining assets in the trust are transferred to a charitable beneficiary, such as a ministry. Now, are there advantages of funding a charitable remainder trust with appreciated stock? There certainly are. And I'd like to focus on three, if I may. First advantage is, again, bypass that capital gain. very important benefit of a charitable remainder trust. Secondly, you can increase your income. Suppose that stock that you're funding, that charitable remainder trust, pays little or no dividends. You can actually see a bump up in your income by using your stock within a charitable remainder trust. And of course, the year you establish and fund that charitable remainder trust, there is a charitable income tax deduction.
Wow, a lot of good things. Jeff, if people got more questions about this, how can they get in contact with you or others in our department? We're happy to give advice, and there's no obligation to people when people do that.
Right. Please contact Jamie Campbell or me or any of our good stewardship team here at CMDA, and they can do that simply by calling toll-free, Dave, 888-230-2637. They can go to our resources on the web at cmdagift.org and type in stock gifts, and there'll be information on that website on how to make this transfer. But we like to talk to our members, so please give us a call anytime.
Yeah, Jeff, and I love our philosophy that we've developed. We're here to help you to become a good steward. If you benefit CMDA, that's wonderful. We sure can use the help. But our main purpose is to help you to be a good steward of what God has entrusted to you, and we're happy to do that at any time. Thanks, Jeff, for being with us.
Thank you, Dave.
It's a pleasure to introduce you to a good friend, Dr. Jeff Keenan. Jeff leads the National Embryo Donation Center. He's a professor at the University of Tennessee Graduate College of Medicine. He's their director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility. He had his training at Jefferson Medical College, an internship at Mercy Hospital in Pittsburgh, a residency at Vanderbilt and OBGYN, and then a fellowship at Hutzel Hospital, Wayne State University in Detroit. Jeff is the doctor who started the National Embryo Donation Center. We're going to tell you a little bit about that story in this interview. You'll look back and wonder what one phone call can do. Let's hear that story and more about this issue. Jeff, it's been, a good number of years. How long ago did the National Embryo Donation Center start? And a few months before that, we had a talk.
Yeah, it was about 4 years before that we had a talk. It was, I think, 1999 you called me up.
Wow.
And said, hey, Jeff, what do you think about this idea? And so it took about 4 years to get all the
pieces together. And we didn't even know each other at that time.
Barely.
Barely.
Yeah. I'd been to a meeting or something here and said hello. And so it took a long time to get all those pieces together, and it was a big undertaking. I think 2003 was when we first got our 501c3 and probably did our first transfer that year or the next year. And first birth was in 2004, which was interesting because that was a physician couple from near CMDA headquarters who had twins. And at this point, things have really exploded. I mean, it's been 13, 14 years after that, but we'll be approaching or maybe having surpassed 700 births by the time this comes out.
Oh, wow. Wow. Last time I heard it was 500. So you guys continue to accelerate.
We do, and it's only limited by me, unfortunately.
Yeah. Talk about that, because I know one of the dreams you have is creating centers other places in the United States that share the biblical view of how this should be done and to serve patients without them having to come such long distance, and secondly, have more capacity.
Well, absolutely, yeah. We really feel that embryonic life is human life. It just at its earliest form, and that we all started as embryos, and we absolutely need to protect that. We need to treat embryos with the dignity and respect that any human life deserves. And so we have taken that approach, and it's been a very popular approach, as it turns out. Many people believe that, and many people are interested in preserving the lives of their embryos, not donating them for research, not discarding them. And so one of the things we do also is to tell couple, or recipient couples, that they will need to have a home study so that the donor families know their embryos are going to a good home. As a result of that, we have received over 1,500 sets of embryos since we started. And even now, we have somewhere close to 500 sets of embryos at the center. And really more than I can adequately serve with all my other duties as being on faculty and having my own private practice. So yes, we would really like to have affiliates all over the country, because this isn't about us or about me in Knoxville. It's about taking care of these embryos and helping other couples. So not only would it allow us to increase our capacity by having affiliates around the country, but it would also allow patients to come at a much lower cost and a lower time commitment to have their embryo transfers. So it would be a win-win if we can find other affiliates.
And you would appreciate some help in Knoxville too, I think.
Yeah, I would. I would appreciate some help in Knoxville. Yes, in fact, we've started putting out the feelers to try to get another reproductive endocrinologist. Would love to have a reproductive endocrinologist that has that view that CMDA shares as well, about when human life begins, and also about the sanctity of marriage between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. And our board has written into the bylaws, as you know, because you helped draft these bylaws way back when, that these embryos will be transferred only into a biblical sacramental union. And that is a very rare thing in reproductive endocrinology these days. Very, very few people practice that. And so it is. It's been a challenge to find the right person.
What kind of pressures have you gotten from your professional body and the media and the government and all the rest of it on this? Because you're taking a very courageous stand on these issues, especially now that same-sex marriage has been legalized. And
well, yes. And we've been fortunate, honestly. I've been thinking for several years now that the first lawsuit is just around the corner. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, God has spared us from that, and we have not had any lawsuits from single or gay couples. They call, and we explain our situation to them. We tell them that there are other places that don't have our ideology or our belief system, and they say thank you, goodbye. And so we have been spared from that. I don't know how much longer that will continue, but it's a difficult thing in our culture now. Our professional body is not
friendly.
Not friendly, to say the least, yes. And they really do not support what we do or how we do it. I mean, they can't really speak out against embryo adoption because, or embryo donation, because they won't even use the word embryo adoption. Mm-hmm. But they won't speak out about that because there are other members who do it. But in the way we do it, and with requiring a home study, they say that that's unethical to do that.
Yeah. They consider those embryos just property.
They absolutely do, and they say this is a medical procedure, and they don't even consider that the donors, what the donors might like.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced, Dave, that this is why we have so many people sending embryos to us, because we take the stance that we do, and they know that their embryos are going to be well cared for. And so we have couples coming every week from places where there is an embryo donation program, but it's small. They don't have many embryos, or they say, well, but we wanted to do it with you guys because we believe the same way you do.
Yeah.
And it's been a blessing, a tremendous blessing to work with these couples. It's really awesome. We get some of the most wonderful couples.
Well, you honor God and God honors you. And that's great. These can be either open adoptions or closed adoptions, I understand.
They can. One of the things that we've done is to really lift any barriers the couples might have to donating their embryos. And some couples are very, very afraid of donating their embryos openly. Mm-hmm. And they really do not want any children that might be born to be able to come back and say, oh, I'm your biologic child. How do you do?
Yeah.
And there are a variety of reasons for that, of course, none of which would appear to be very legitimate, but sometimes our fears overcome our rational thinking. And so the things that we do is we say you can donate your embryos completely anonymously, or you can make any stipulations you want on the embryo recipients. That is, if a couple is Jewish and they want Jewish recipients, we say fine. If they're from Maine and they say, we want a recipient from New Mexico, we say, fine. If they're Christian and they want a Christian family, or if they're teachers and they want another, you know, teacher family, we don't make any, we allow them to make any conditions they want to on donating their embryos, because we'll be able to find recipients for them. That's not the issue. The issue is to try and save, preserve the life of these embryos.
Yeah. What doctors out there listening to this, nurse practitioners, others, how can they be of help to you?
Well, I think what I've always said is our goal is to try to put ourselves out of business. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the best things that we could do as a medical profession, and I'll take it out of just the reproductive endocrinology sphere, is we need to be talking to our patients about whether or not, if they're going through IVF, they really need to create all these excess embryos. Because today, in 2017, it is not medically necessary to do that, and we continue to do it. And it's uncommon that I would try to inseminate all of the oocytes to create as many embryos as I can. It's just, I mean, there are some situations where it is medically indicated, but that's uncommon. And so couples need to be talking to their physicians about limiting that. And I think the other physicians listening to this are going to encounter patients who are going through in vitro fertilization in the hopes of building their family. And they can say to their patients, you need to talk with your physician and tell them that you don't want to create as many embryos as possible. You want to create a limited number of embryos, and you want to freeze your eggs, your oocytes, because an oocyte does not have the intrinsic or inherent value that an embryo does.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for years that was a problem, and now that's pretty much been solved.
It absolutely has. Yeah, we're actually very competent, very good at cryopreservation through a process called vitrification of oocytes that is a very different way to freeze something, and it works very well, and they've done enough studies now to know that there do not appear to be any problems with the embryos or the children that develop from these vitrified oocytes, and that they appear to be essentially as good as a fresh oocyte as far as creating a birth.
And for years, it was, you know, let's get as many eggs as we can, fertilize all of them, stick them in the freezer, and then if you need them, we'll have them and won't have to go through the procedure again. And nobody's thinking about, we've got how many children in the freezer.
Right, and the success rates for in vitro fertilization have more than doubled during my career.
Yeah.
And so we've doubled our success rates, but we're still trying to create as many embryos as we ever did. And so our common sense kind of did not keep up with our technology.
Yeah. If people are interested in referring patients to you for adoption, how would they get hold of you? What's the easiest way?
The easiest way is to reach out through our website. We have donor and recipient applications on the website, but of course our phone number is there as well, and the website is embryodonation.org.
Well, Jeff, it's been wonderful what you've done, the lives you've saved, and the courage you've had, and the words you've gotten out. You talked about embryo adoption all over the country. I mean, you got some grants and sent people out all over the country, letting people know you were there, and it's exciting to see what God's done. I just want to thank you.
Well, absolutely, and I just want to again say, because not everyone knows that this was your idea, and
I yeah, but I didn't do all the work. I was chairman of the board for a year or two, and then I was on to the next thing.
Yeah, but we appreciate your idea, and we've loved working with CMDA, and CMDA and this ministry has been a tremendous blessing.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible to see how God works in all this. You just kind of open your eyes to it, and it's really amazing. It's a joy.
Great interview with Jeff, and I just pray that you will pray for him. He's a target because they don't do assisted reproduction for unmarried or same-sex couples, and, you know, government and media and others are looking for targets in these areas, and he has stood bravely and with great courage to speak the truth in love as he helps so many couples. And I want to give you a great resource to educate yourself on this issue. No matter what your practice, you may have patients asking you about IVF, and also friends or colleagues that need a good resource on this issue. The best one I know is by Scott Ray and Joy Riley. Joy Riley's one of our members. She's the physician. It's called Outside the Womb, Moral Guidance for Assisted Reproduction. And this is an area where people get themselves in problems quickly if they don't know what the Bible's principles are on this issue and how to plan ahead. Chuck Colson talked about this book and said a thorough, thoughtful look at the complexities of assisted reproduction. It's a great resource, and we have it here at CMDA. If you want to give us a call at 888-230-2637 or go to our website at cmda.org, go to the resource button, and you'll find it there. Hey, I got a lot of great events to tell you about. And the first one is the CMDA Dawson Retreat. Pete Dawson's the most famous dentist in the world. When I heard about Pete, I said, well, I didn't know there was the most famous dentist in the world. Well, Pete is him. He's trained over 40,000 dentists in Dawson academies around the world, from California to South America to England, you name it. They have Dawson academies there. He's written a couple of the standard textbooks. Godly man. He's going to be at this retreat. Originally, it was just for dentists, and now we've expanded it to let any health professional and their spouse come. It's going to be at the beautiful Ritz-Carlton in Bachelor Gulch in Avon, Colorado. The dates are October 25th through the 29th. We have a stellar lineup of speakers for this, and it's just a great couple's weekend away. That's what it's targeted towards. Registration is limited to 100 couples, so don't wait. Reserve a spot October 25th through the 29th. Go to cmda.org. Hope to see you there. We got a marriage enrichment weekends coming up. Palm Coast, Florida at the Hammock Beach Resort, October 13th through the 15th. cmda.org/marriage can give you more information about that. The CMD National Winter Conference is going to be here at headquarters. Come on down. We'd love to have you come by to our house. Well, it's actually your house. We get to work in it here at headquarters. The guest speaker is going to be our CMDA president, Dr. Al Weir, and he's going to be talking about the 12 steps to Christian decision-making, finding God's direction for life's decisions. Perfect event for students and residents as well as graduate docs. So if you're not able to come, encourage others to do it. And then we've got a new big box conference coming up in March next year. You know, for years, we've been doing Global Missions Health Conference. That idea came on a GHO mission trip, and we've been very involved behind the scenes in making that happen. It's grown to over 3,000 attendees, but we know most of them come within about a six-hour drive. And so we're going to start another similar conference called Remedy, because the Global Missions Health Conference is always called the Louisville Conference because nobody can remember its name. But it's going to be the Remedy Conference. It's going to be held at the First Baptist Church in Orlando, March 23rd through the 24th of 2018. Plenary speakers are lined up and workshops are being put together, and it's going to be a tremendous conference, and this is a great church to have it in. I've been down there, and it's going to be right during spring break time, so you can bring the family and attend. The conference starts Friday morning in Saturday noon, so you still have most of the week for vacation or whatever. Encourage students to come. If you're involved with students, residents, family members, it's going to be an inspirational and equipping conference, and we pray that it's going to grow just like the Global Missions Health Conference has in Louisville to really impact medical missions around the world. And of course, the next conference after that that you need to be aware of is April 26th through the 29th, and that's CMDA's national meeting at Ridgecrest Conference Center. We call it Transformation Conference because that's our goal and that's our vision for CMDA. Wonderful children's programs, children's care for the younger ones, great speakers, workshops, wonderful fellowship, a beautiful sight that time of year. I hope to see you there. It's a delight to introduce you to Casey Maddox. He's a senior counsel and director for the Center of Academic Freedom at the Alliance Defending Freedom. I've known Casey since he was a lawyer at the Christian Legal Society in 2004, and he joined ADF in 2009. We've worked together on many cases. In fact, we work the Christian Legal Society, Alliance Defending Freedom, the Beckett Fund, defending issues that you're concerned about. Over 50 amicus curiae briefs since I've been here. Cases before the Supreme Court. We have sued two states over issues, brought a suit against Health and Human Services over their transgender mandate, just lots of issues. But we're also seeing a lot of issues of academic freedom increasingly on medical school and dental school campuses across the country. They're trying to force Christian groups off the campus because they don't allow non-Christians to lead their organizations. And it's kind of like, what? You mean somebody who's not a Christian would lead a Christian organization? Well, there was a legal case that kind of gave that idea to groups, and Casey has been very involved in helping us defend CMDA on campuses across the country. He's got a broad background. He has his doctorate of jurisprudence from Boston College of Law. He's clerk for the Alabama Supreme Court. He's a member of the bar in Virginia and the U.S. Supreme Court and a number of courts of appeals and D.C. Circuit Court and federal courts. He's been all over the country. He's done numerous media experiences, USA Today, The Washington Times, The Federalist, Town Hall, and many others. He's a good friend and somebody we call when we get a group in problems. ADF is often the group we're picking up the phone to discuss with, and they jump in to help us. So it's time to, for you to learn some of the things he knows. He came and spoke to the board where I was on a university board, and it was such excellent information. I thought, I've got to get him on Christian Doctors Digest, and now you're going to have that privilege. Casey, I've been wanting to get back together with you, just kind of get an update on religious liberty, and especially in the area where I know you specialize in, and that is academic freedom on campuses, and we need to be aware of that as CMDA members as well. And I, in particular, since I serve on a university board, I hear about these issues every time we have a meeting. What's going on? We've got a new administration. Where are we?
Well, you know, I think the good news is that I've been battling these university free speech battles for about 15 years, and at this point, the good news is we no longer have to argue that there is a First Amendment problem on university campuses, because you look around and it's patently obvious. You have speakers like Charles Murray at Middlebury, and you know, the Ann Coulter situation that was happening at Berkeley, but virtually any speaker on campus these days is facing these sorts of problems. And so, you know, the unfortunate fact is that that there persists in being a First Amendment problem on campus. The good news is that that everyone seems to acknowledge it now, that we have somehow gone wrong in the way we've been teaching students about the importance of hearing other people's opinions. And that at least opens up the opportunity to get this fixed.
I know, and I get publications from, I forget the name of the group, but essentially it services boards at universities across the campus, I mean across the country, and this topic comes up regularly, and they're putting out memorandums on it and what universities need to be doing about it. I mean, it's even penetrating at the board level on these campuses because there's a lot of concern. Where do you see things going? I mean, people realize the problem, but it seems like we just hear more and more about this happening.
Well, you know, it's as it is with just about anything. It's both a law problem and a culture problem, and they're tightly connected. We've had for many years universities mistakenly treating students as if they were not individual students that have a contractual relationship with the school, but trying to sweep them in as if they are part of the institution itself. And the result of that has been these university policies that try to control students. And the impact of that, of years of university policies that try to limit where students can speak, tell them what they can say, you know, who can make up the leadership of student organizations, none of which the school should have hardly anything to do with, because these are individuals expressing themselves. the result of all that has been to teach students that First Amendment rights can be waived, and that they come from university administrators, not from an all-powerful creator who has, and we don't have these rights inalienably, they come from the school. And so then students decide that they're going to shut down other people's expression. So, you know, I think it's tightly connected. We have to get rid of these bad policies on these campuses, the speech codes and the speech zones and all these issues. And then hopefully that will pave the way for students to be having a better understanding of how the First Amendment is supposed to be working on their own campuses.
How much do you see that students are even getting any education in this area? I mean, you know, you hear of all these, you know, so-called courses that don't seem to have much academic core to them, and then the basics like, you know, American government and other issues, you know, kids just don't have often. And even I've never read the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or anything else, maybe even in their whole academic career. I mean, some of this is lack of education, is it not?
I think that's exactly right. You know, and you have to understand, these are students who the first real interaction that they've had with government, other than going to the DMV when they were 16, right? Yeah. The first real opportunity they've had to really understand what it's like to live as a citizen in a democratic republic is to wake up every day on a university campus with administrators and professors who are paid by the government. So this is a brand new thing for them. And instead of being told, these are what your rights are, they're handed a 100-page student handbook that lists all of the restrictions on them, where you're allowed to speak, who you need to get permission from in order to speak, what you're allowed to say, how to manage your student group. We'll practically draft your entire student group constitution for you and give you a couple of, you know, fill in the blanks that you're only permitted to change. All those sorts of issues that we see come up. And then you think about, you know, what happens to these students. They don't stay on those campuses. And so we're educating. That's where it really, I think, is a serious concern about the future. We're educating these students to think that way, that this is how, you know, how they should interact as a citizen in this country. And then they leave those campuses and they become our legislators and our judges and our voters. Mm-hmm. And so we have to get this fixed on the university level because they're going to impact the rest of our culture.
Yeah, and we're already beginning to see that things going on. That it's going to impact the whole country and religious liberty for all of us, as well as free speech rights. What do you see, I mean, as you look at that spillover effect that's already taking place, where are we there?
Well, you know, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. We've seen, you know, decades of students coming from universities with a poorly understood framework for how the Constitution works. You know, when you're taught at, you know, for 4 years at your university that the First Amendment is essentially too dangerous to really be permitted, that free speech is something that you know, can't be just fully enjoyed because it will interfere with other people's rights. Well, it shouldn't be a big surprise to us then that those people then leave. They become state legislators who seem to have the same mindset that we can't freely permit First Amendment rights to be exercised because other people will be impacted. Instead of thinking, well, look, everyone is going to have different opinions, and that's okay. The fact that you have a different view does not give us a reason to stifle some views or to not allow you to exercise your religious freedom, for example. So, you know, I think that's it's really critical that we better instill an understanding of these fundamental rights on the university campuses in order to make sure that our culture is not led down the path of becoming Berkeley.
Yeah. How do we do that, though? I mean, these campuses, Berkeley's a great example of that. You know, many of the professors and administrators are in total agreement with this. And so I don't know how you move them in that direction, even though boards may be talking some about it. Some boards aren't, I'm sure. How do we do this, and is it going to take more regulation? What's it going to have to do to make it happen?
Sure. Well, you know, a number of states have stepped up, and state legislatures have said, we're just not going to permit these schools to continue to have this kind of control over student speech. And so they've enacted laws in a number of states that have restrained the power of these schools to impose those kinds of speech rules on students. That's happening on one side, and I think that's positive. You know, while it's regulation that's eliminating regulations.
So right.
That's a different kind of thing. You know, obviously, we we file lawsuits on these issues. We sue schools where they violated First Amendment rights. We sued about a dozen different schools in the last year alone. You know, everything from speech codes to speech zones to student activity funding, where they will skew, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to one side of the debate and exclude the other side of the debate on critical topics. And a lot of those cases are for groups like Students for Life. I think it's about half of our cases this past year have been for Students for Life groups across the country that are facing a lot of restrictions on their ability to be pro-life on campus.
Are we winning in court? I mean, you know, if you wait too late, then the courts are filled with people who are not going to side with you on the case either as judges look at this.
No, that's right. So we have a very good track record in court, actually. Our Center for Academic Freedom has a 90% success rate in litigation.
Oh, that's great.
In every instance in which we've challenged a speech zone telling students this is where you're allowed to speak and this is where you're not, we've won every one of those cases. One of those is pending right now is actually a student at Georgia Gwinnett College in suburban Atlanta, just making the point that this is not a red state, blue state problem. Even in suburban Atlanta, a student wanted to share his faith, was told you have to go to this one patio, and you have to get permission 3 days in advance to use the patio to be able to speak about your faith. And then when he did that and went through the whole permit process and everything, he was then told that he would have to stop because other students were offended by what they heard him say. It was actually, the line was that he had disturbed the peace and tranquility of other students by sharing the gospel, which is both constitutionally problematic and factually true. That's the whole point of the gospel, is to disturb the peace and tranquility of people. And he did that effectively, so he should wear that as a badge of honor, I guess. But that's a good example, I think, of what students face on these universities. And it's not just, as I said, happening in California and in New York. It's happening even in places like Georgia.
How's this affecting our country? I mean, let's step back and look at it from a bigger point of view, because we're reaping some of this, as, for example, in Vermont right now, where we're suing the state with you guys at ADF over the fact that there's an effort to force doctors to counsel for physician-assisted suicide and refer for it. So it's a freedom of speech issue, and it's a healthcare right of conscience issue. We're seeing this spill out already, and it's impacting those of us who've maybe had a better education on these issues decades ago.
No, that's right. So, you know, you'll see these universities that will enact these speech codes and speech zones, and they're basically communicating to their students that some views just can't be fully expressed, and that, you know, your free speech rights end where other people are offended. And, you know, as offensive as that is on the university campus, it's the impact that that has on the rest of culture. When these students then, these ideas become ingrained that, you know, your First Amendment rights, basically the First Amendment is just a nice starting point, but if administrators or government officials decide that there are some instances in which the First Amendment is too dangerous to be allowed, or other rights that are preeminent above First Amendment rights, that government can just set aside your First Amendment rights and order you not to, you know, order you to stand down. And that's what we see, I think, with a lot of these conscience battles, even the free speech battles more broadly. I mean, you now have politicians that will openly call for elimination of what they will refer to as hate speech, which is unfortunately, you know, defined essentially as just speech that they hate.
Yeah, it's a good way to define it.
When you have politicians, making those arguments, those are arguments that just a decade or so ago would have been laughed at by a lot more people. But when everyone is being trained to think that there are certain kinds of speech that offend other people, and that that speech should not be allowed, it creates an atmosphere where those ideas can actually have some credence in civil society because people have gone through this university environment where it's normal.
Yeah. Where do you see things heading right now? We've got the, at least being talked about, nobody's arguing this not going on, but looking at it in the bigger picture, interlude here, at least in this administration, though there's a lot of issues going on and how successful we're going to be in getting some address to these issues is still up in the air. But what do you see?
Well, I think legislatively, I think we're going to see some progress. The Higher Education Act is up for reauthorization this year. And, you know, one of the things we're hoping is that the when it's reauthorized and the hundreds of millions of dollars that go to universities through the HEA is being considered, that there will also be guarantees there that if these universities are going to receive the amount of taxpayer dollars that they are, that they're actually turning out graduates who are prepared to be citizens in this republic. So I think we will see some language to that effect, both protecting student free speech rights, rights of association for religious and political student groups to be able to choose their own leaders. I think that's a critically important thing, and we hope to see it on the HEA. As I mentioned, we've seen a number of states that are enacting laws, but I think most importantly is just this, you know, the very good news is that you now have people on the left, faculty, administrators, and others on the left who have seen what is happening on these campuses and realize that the restrictions that they were willing to put on free speech are having some severe negative consequences. And so we're now starting to see some some pressure across the political aisle from people recognizing that this is a problem that has to be addressed, because it's beginning to, when you have the sorts of issues that have erupted at places like Berkeley, at Cal State Los Angeles, where we represented Ben Shapiro, professors literally linking arms to block access to his event. Even folks on the left have had to acknowledge this has gotten out of hand.
Yeah. And moving more into totalitarianism, not just free speech issues, but it goes on and has huge political implications and for the future of our country. As we look down the road, what are we going to become if this continues? I think another thing, perhaps, Casey, is we need to get more people that believe in free speech into academic positions. And of course, that's very difficult on a lot of campuses as well. But the balance has swung so much to the left in academic appointments that these things have happened as they have, and administrative appointments.
No, I think that's true. And, you know, there is a real problem of people on the right, particularly evangelical believers on the right, being unwilling to go into academia, not because they're not qualified, but because they know that they will face the kind of headwinds that they will on those campuses. And it's often the case that where you find a Christian professor, if you're a student on campus and you find a Christian professor, it's usually someone in a position that is sort of where their faith is not going to cause difficulty for them. You'll find a structural engineering professor or something of that sort, not someone in the humanities,
right,
where their faith would actually come up and be an issue. And that's a real problem. It's a problem because a diversity of views is not being presented, but it's also a problem because those students then lack mentors on campuses. The conservative and Christian students have a difficult time finding people who can mentor them and show them how you should become an educated believer in your field of study. That's something I think that CMDA members can be very helpful at, is trying to be very intentional there. You're a highly educated group of Christian professionals who I think have an obligation to look at the next generation and take it on yourself to say, we're not going to let these folks have to figure all this out on their own. We're going to find some opportunities where we can help show them what it's like to be a faithful believer in this field. And, I think that's a desperately needed service that you all can provide the next generation.
Yeah, I agree. And, we focus on medical, dental, and other healthcare campuses, but your reach can be far beyond your own profession just because you have that degree after your name. Casey, let me say here in front of all of our members, thank you to ADF for all you've partnered. I don't know how many cases we've done with you guys. And we're in some right now, and briefs that we've helped file, and now even suits and all the rest of it. And I just want to say thank you, and take a few minutes and just share with them kind of the scope of ADF and the kind of things you do. Some people are very familiar with you guys, some are not, but I want all of our members to know more about ADF and the wonderful partnership we have with you.
Well, thank you, and it's a blessing to work with you guys. So ADF is, we're one of the largest religious liberty-focused legal organizations in the world, if not the largest, I guess, about 230 team members, roughly about 60 of which are actually attorneys. And we are actually international. We have a number of offices in Europe, in Mexico, and other places around the globe. But on the domestic side, we focus principally on religious liberty and defending the sanctity of life, and then defending the free speech rights of students on university campuses. So that's what we do. We serve. We exist to try to advance that mission, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to partner with CMDA so many times over the years to make that happen.
Casey, thanks for being with us. Thank you for your personal faithfulness. You've been a warrior, and not only with us, but I've seen you speak on college campuses and to boards, and seen the tremendous impact you have in educating and advocating and speaking out and standing up for religious freedom and academic freedom and free speech. So thank you for your faithfulness as an individual, and pass on our appreciation to all your colleagues for all they're doing for the kingdom.
I will do that. Thank you very much.
ADF has been a wonderful friend, and can't say enough about this group. Visiting their offices, and it's been a blessing to see all they do for the kingdom. I want to recommend a great resource to you. You know Albert Mohler. He's been on Christian Doctors Digest. He's got a new one out called We Cannot Be Silent, Speaking Truths to a Culture, Redefining Sex, Marriage, and the Very Meaning of Right and Wrong. And Albert is so articulate and so good in the public square. I encourage you to get a copy of this book. We have it available here at cmda.org online, or you can call us at 888-230-2637. I know you're busy, but there's so much going on that you've got to educate yourself on these issues for the sake of your patients, for the sake of your family, for the sake of your community. You need to use your voice to make a difference, and these books will help equip you to do that. Over the next couple issues of CMDA's Christian Doctors Digest, I thought I'd take an opportunity to kind of update you on what's happening. CMDA has so much going on all the time. I'm talking to people and they say, well, I wish CMDA would do that. And I'd say, well, we are. Let me tell you about that. And realize that, you know, we got so much going on, it's hard for you to keep up with it. So we've got, goal is to motivate, train, and equip Christian doctors to glorify God. And our vision is transform doctors, transforming the world. And we have five key result areas. Let me just cover two. First is transformation. And transformation is all our student and graduate ministries. It's our evangelism. It's our discipleship, helping students come to Christ, colleagues come to Christ, and then discipling Christians and helping to combine their Christian walk with their practice of healthcare. What does that look like? And we have grown tremendously. I remember when I came on at CMDA, we had, seven or eight regional directors, and that was it. They just had the country divided up, and we probably had maybe 150 campuses. Right now, we're on 282 campuses, and we have 75 full or part-time staff that are working. And what we found out is if we get a local council formed, a group of doctors that come together and say, we're going to take responsibility for ministry in our area, we come alongside, train them, then often they'll say, we need a part-time, full-time staff. We'll help them recruit, help supervise that. They'll help raise the funds at the local level. And the ministry just enormously expands. The first place we did that was San Antonio. They probably had 15, 20 students coming to the meeting each week. Now they average 200. They're doing mission trips every month during the school year with students. They have retreats. They have banquets. They have Bible studies. And they're just having a tremendous impact. And so as we look at Campus Community Ministries, we want to continue to grow that, not only spread out to more campuses as new ones are formed, but also really take our ministry into greater depth. So pray for that. And then, of course, Women Physicians for Christ, great ministry for women healthcare professionals, and they do retreats and resources and devotionals and all sorts of things targeted towards this growing area of ministry. Over 50% of students now are female, and they have special needs that we want to deal with. We have our ministry with Marriage Commission doing marriage conferences. There's just lots of things that fit under campus and community ministries. Our sections are for different specialties. Our sections for PA, section for nurse practitioner, we just started. A section that is physical therapist, a section for optometrists that have come under our umbrella. We know that with what's happening in healthcare, we as Christians need to hang together. We're going to hang separately. So pray for Campus Community Ministries. It's our biggest ministry. It's our most important outreach. It's the foundation of why we started, and it's the most important thing we do. Secondly is service, and that's all our mission outreaches. And CMDA is really involved from recruiting up to sustaining medical missionaries around the world. Over about 700, 800 members are medical missionaries. The Global Missions Health Conference grew out of CMDA, a mission trip that I led and a conversation that we had, and now has grown to over 3,000 in attendance, 200 exhibitors, 120 workshops, and it's been a great recruitment tool to get more missionaries to the field. We're starting another conference similar to it in this next March in Orlando, Florida, called Remedy. And we know most people come to the GMHC within a six-hour drive, so we're going to other areas of the country to try to create this to have more outreach. Then we have Your Call, which is a mentoring program for students and residents who have been called to the mission field during their long days of training. New medical missionary orientation. We've trained close to 400 new medical missionaries before they head out to the field. We have the Commission on Medical and Dental Education, and that does a wonderful conference for up to 750 in attendance, families with children's programs, spousal programs, and 10 days, four streams of continuing medical and dental education, 100 volunteer staff or more who pay their own way to go. It's the best medical dental meeting in the world, and that's either in Greece or Thailand. The Center for Medical Missions Network sustains, chairs resources, gives information to our missionaries on the field. They do the new missionary training. They do the summit in September, which is bringing mission organizations together, executives, to network, to study and learn about medical missions and to share great ideas and do research. And we'll be doing that with 100 missionary executives at the beginning of September this year. So a lot of things going on. Scholarships for students. Here's how to find a rotation overseas. We have all that information online. And so much more. Publishing and medical missions. And so God is doing a lot of great things. These are two of the five important areas we're dealing with. But CMDS has over 45 different ministries now and outreaches. I encourage you to pray. We need your prayers and participate where God leads you, because you'll be blessed and God will bless through you. I hope that explains a little bit more about CMDA. Go to the website. You'll learn a lot more. And thank you for being part of what CMDA is doing in this country and literally around the world.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.